From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, the first thing we at least ought to agree is to be honest. If we don't want to be honest, then let's just stop the discussion.
Noam Chomsky and Edward Said on the bombing of Yugoslavia.
The policy now of bombing has to be seen in the context of U.S. moves elsewhere. That is to say, at the same time that this action is taking place, a kind of clean war, a safe war, there is a war being waged by a NATO ally, Turkey, against the Kurds. 46,000 Kurds have been killed.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. NATO said today it had attacked an oil refinery near the Yugoslav capital Belgrade and targets at Novi Sad in overnight air raids. Serbian television showed fires raging at the refinery in Pančevo on the east bank of the Danube across from Belgrade. It's been targeted several times since NATO began bombing Yugoslavia almost 3 weeks ago. Yugoslav media have reported that a missile hit a residential area in the northern city of Novi Sad yesterday. The NATO official said a surface-to-air SAM missile facility was operating in the region. And the official Yugoslav news agency Tanjug said there were two raids on military barracks in Pristina, the Kosovo capital, earlier today, and that NATO planes have been flying overhead all morning. As usual, it gave no details of casualties or damage. Meanwhile, Yugoslavia may be trying to draw Russia into the fighting. The Yugoslav parliament met in an urgent session today and approved setting up an alliance with Russia and Belarus. The move comes as NATO foreign ministers convene in Belgium for first time in 3 weeks. Meanwhile, Germany has put forward a Kosovo peace plan under which an OSCE-led international force rather than NATO would replace Serbian forces in the province. This, according to Britain's Guardian newspaper today. The OSCE is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The fate of the plan is likely to hinge on the meeting of the NATO foreign ministers in Brussels. And Kosovo Liberation Army guerrillas and Serb forces fought on the Yugoslav-Albanian frontier for a fourth day today as the Kosovo conflict threatens to spill over the border. According to Albanian police and OSCE officials, three Albanian citizens and four KLA fighters have been killed on Albanian territory during fighting involving machine gun fire and Serb mortar attacks, some against villages and border posts. China could enter the World Trade Organization by the end of the year if the momentum of negotiations is sustained. This according to Charlene Barshefsky, the U.S. trade representative. However, significant work needs to be done on a number of issues to secure Chinese entry, she said. The U.S. and China failed last week to agree a deal on WTO entry that would have capped a summit meeting between President Bill Clinton and Zhu Rongyi, the Chinese premier. Japan and Egypt today said they would work together for peace in Palestine and the Middle Eastern region as a whole, according to a Japanese foreign ministry official. But the Japanese Prime Minister Obuchi and Egyptian Prime Minister Mubarak appeared to break little new ground on the question of the timing of a declaration of an independent Palestinian state. Obuchi said Japan supported the Palestinians' right to decide their independence and hoped the Palestinian Central Council would meet soon, leading to an independent Palestinian state in the near future. Mubarak did not directly touch on the issue of when Palestine should declare independence. But the two leaders agreed that Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat appeared to understand that declaring statehood on May 4th would not be desirable. Yesterday, Israeli war planes attacked suspected Hezbollah positions just north of Israel's South Lebanon occupation zone. This according to a security source. The planes fired four rockets and two successive raids on the Iklim al-Tufa ridges north of the central sector of the zone. There was no immediate report of casualties in the attacks, which brought to 41 the number of Israeli air raids on Lebanon since the beginning of 1999. Meanwhile, U.S. warplanes attacked two Iraqi surface-to-air missile sites in the southern no-fly zone after being fired on with anti-aircraft artillery, this according to a U.S. Defense Department spokesperson. In Baghdad, Iraq said two people had been killed and nine wounded in the attack on the no-fly zone that is imposed only by the United States and Britain. A representative of the U.S. Central Command said he had no information on the civilian casualties. In Connecticut, suicides at the state prison for women have prompted a call by the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union for a court review. The CCLU has asked a federal court judge to send an independent monitoring panel into the York Correctional Institution in East Lyme. And a federal report finds male and female prisoners have a higher rate of being abused as children than those not in prison. The Justice Department says of the female state prison and jail inmates it surveyed in 1996 and 97, more than a third say they were abused sexually or physically at the age of 17 or younger. NATO struck at Serbia's industrial heartland today, returning to sites already hard hit in the Allied air campaign. As NATO foreign ministers convened today in Belgium for their first meeting since airstrikes began nearly 3 weeks ago, refugee agencies continue to express deep concern over the more than half million ethnic Albanians who have left Kosovo and hundreds of thousands of others displaced within the province. Well, as the mainstream media here in the United States continues to cover the war in Yugoslavia through the voices of military experts, NATO spokespeople, and U.S. government officials, we are going to bring you something else. The discussion in these next few days as Congress goes back into session is about options. That's right. The way the mainstream media in this country defines options is whether the airstrikes should be followed by ground troops. That's the spectrum of discussion that takes place in most of the media. Today, we'll bring you voices of dissent that have been effectively blocked out almost everywhere else. We first turn to two of America's most respected political dissidents, Noam Chomsky and Edward Said. They spoke last Friday at Columbia University at a special event on the Middle East. We're going to first hear from Edward Said and then Noam Chomsky as they go back and forth on the issue of Kosovo. Their major addresses were about the Middle East, but at the end of the question and answer period, a student from Columbia University asked what they felt about the bombing. Edward Said is professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University and analyst on Middle East politics. He's written over a dozen books, including Peace and Its Discontents, Essays on Palestine and the Middle East Peace Process, also Orientalism and Culture and Imperialism. He was a member of the Palestine Liberation Council between 1977 and 1991 when he left. Noam Chomsky is a world-renowned linguist, scholar, and political analyst, author of dozens of books, including Manufacturing Consent, Profit Over People. We first turn to Edward Said responding to that question about the bombing of Yugoslavia.
I don't want to give a whole thing on the current situation in Yugoslavia, but a number of things need to be said. In the first place, obviously, I mean, I try to emphasize this in my talk. I mean, I see the evils of ethnic cleansing and forced dispossession, which is taking place by the forces of Serbia under Milosevic, and there's obviously a parallel there between what happened to Palestinians in 1948. And I certainly want also to add, since you talked about Iraq, that there can be no brief at all for what Saddam Hussein has wrought on the people of Iraq and the neighborhood. But one should remember that these are not things that happened out of context and just suddenly discovered the monstrosity of these regimes. Saddam was supported very, very methodically during the 80s, especially during the Iran-Iraq war, by the United States and the European powers. And Milosevic was always involved. I mean, the Dayton Accord made a point of really sort of sidelining the Bosnians and dealing with Milosevic. And the Kosovars, of course. So the policy now of bombing has to be seen in the context of of U.S. moves elsewhere. That is to say, at the same time that this action is taking place, a kind of clean war, safe war, no U.S. pilots hurt, et cetera, with these smart bombs and so on and so forth, devastation of a country. There is a war being waged by a NATO ally, Turkey, against the Kurds. 46,000 Kurds have been killed, and not a word has been said about this by the United States, which simply tolerates it. I think these false dichotomies, either you're with, as it used to be said during the Gulf War, either you're for fascism or you're for imperialism, and you have to be for imperialism because it's always slightly better than fascism. I mean, fascism being something. These are the kind of false dichotomies we're placed into at the current moment, and I think that the net result, again, without any particular plan, without any notion of what's going to be done afterwards, given the history of other refugees in the last 50 years, it seems unlikely that this action on the part of NATO and the United States is going to produce anything except more destruction and more fragmentation and dispossession, and probably at the end Clinton will walk away and say he had a success.
Well, I'll be brief. I think the first thing we ought to do when facing this, it's a difficult and complicated issue, but the first thing we at least ought to agree is to be honest. If we don't want to be honest, then let's just stop the discussion. If we're willing to be honest, we see instantly that it cannot possibly be an operation resulting from humanitarian concerns. I mean, that's just trivial. Let's take the one example that Edward mentioned, in which, incidentally, I disagree with him. He said that the U.S. ignored the Turkish atrocities in Kurdistan, which is absolutely untrue, as he agrees, I'm sure. The U.S. worked as hard as it could to escalate those atrocities. In fact, this is not ancient history. I mean, atrocities in southeastern Turkey, which are well beyond Kosovo, peaked in 1994. It was the peak year of atrocities. It was also the peak year of U.S. provision of weapons under Clinton to Turkey. That included jet planes, napalm, anti-personnel weapons, tanks, all of which were used. In fact, Turkey became the biggest importer of weapons in the world, thanks to the huge supply of weapons that Clinton was offering them to consummate a destruction and massacre, which unfortunately is well beyond what's happening in Kosovo, or had happened. Remember, 2,000 people were killed there last year, according to NATO. And in fact, Clinton even had to evade congressional restrictions. Human rights groups found that U.S. jets were being used illegally to bomb Kurds, and the humanitarian Clinton had to find ways of evading those restrictions to allow the jet planes to keep going, to keep bombing Kurds. So that's just one example of many. There's no possibility that this is a humanitarian operation. That leaves us with the question whether you should carry it out. Okay, separate question. So now you look and see. Where were we on March 24th when the bombing started? Well, there, according to NATO, had been 2,000 people killed in the past year as Serbians responded brutally to KLA attacks on police stations and so on. And so you might ask yourself how the United States would respond to attacks on police stations in New York by a guerrilla group being supported by, say, Libya and based across the border. I'll just put that aside. But in any event, the response was brutal. A couple thousand people were killed, a few hundred thousand refugees. On March 24th, the way the situation stood I actually learned something interesting in the New York Times yesterday, hidden down at the bottom of a column. The place where it's usually useful to begin reading. Turns out, I didn't know this before, that the Serbian parliament had called for UN forces to be in Kosovo as observers, whereas the U.S. was insisting on NATO forces. Well, that's consistent with U.S. contempt for and hatred for the United Nations or any other international institution, but it does put a rather different cast on the situation. There were clearly negotiating opportunities and options that could be pursued. The U.S. picked one option. It was an option which was guaranteed, practically, to make the situation far worse. I won't express my opinion. Let me just quote the U.S. NATO commander. On March 26th, Wesley Clark, 2 days after the bombing started, He said, in his words, it was entirely predictable that as a result of the bombing, there would be a vast escalation of Serbian atrocities on the ground. Well, you know, entirely predictable is too strong. The world isn't that simple. Nothing's entirely predictable. But it was certainly pretty obvious that they were going to react somehow, and they were going to react where they have strength. Well, they don't have strength in the air. You know. They have strength on the ground. So they were going to react the way they did, you know, by sharply increasing attacks and so on. If you look at the number of refugees, the UN had registered zero refugees in Albania and Macedonia. There were some, but they weren't registered by the UN as of March 26th, in fact. That's when the refugee flow started. It's after the bombing. The effects of the bombing, rather predictably, not entirely predictably, as the NATO general stated, rather predictably were to sharply increase the damage to the populations, the harm to the populations, very severely, all populations. Other effects were to wipe out a very promising and courageous democratic movement in Belgrade, which was the best hope for getting rid of this gangster Milosevic with whom we'd been dealing. It's having, I mean, everyone rallies around the flag, you know, just the way we would do if New York started getting bombed. So that's gone, at least for the moment, maybe forever. The very harsh effects in the surrounding regions. There is yet another attack on the system of international law and world order. Well, like if you're Saddam Hussein, you don't take this very seriously. But maybe not everybody accepts the standards of Saddam Hussein. Maybe there's some people who think that we ought to have some sort of regime of international order, which provides at least some support for the weak. Doesn't provide any support for the strong. They don't need it. But it provides some, the restrictions against the use of force provide some protection for the weak. Okay, we have another blow against that. In fact, across the board, it's a disaster. It's a human disaster. Forgetting even the possibility that this had humanitarian motives, which of course it didn't, we have to ask what it meant. Well, that's approximately what it meant. It doesn't look very much in doubt. And it looks as if there were alternatives. And there still are alternatives, as there always are. In fact, let me just put the whole thing at a kind of mundane level. Like, suppose you walk out in the street this evening and you see a crime being committed. You know, somebody's robbing someone else. Well, you have three choices. One choice is to try to stop it, you know, like maybe call 911 or something. Another choice is to do nothing. A third choice is to pick up an assault rifle and kill them both and kill the bystanders at the same time, you know. Well, suppose you do that and somebody says, well, you know, why'd you do that? And they said, look, I couldn't stand by and do nothing, you know. I mean, is that a response, you know? If you can think of nothing that wouldn't do harm, then do nothing. You know? And the same is true, magnified in international affairs, apart from the fact that there were things that could have been done.
But I want to add one other thing, if I may. That is, at the same time that this war is going on, the United States is continuing to bomb Iraq, again, on the bottom pages of the New York Times. And I think one of the demonstrations, behind the action in Yugoslavia is a kind of projection of U.S. power and the assertion that the U.S. can fight regional wars more than one, maybe two, three, four at a time. And interestingly, one of your favorite columnists, Tom Friedman, the other day was saying in the New York Times that it's a sort of repetition of some of the tactics used during the Indo-Chinese episode, that is to say, to appear as irrational as possible. And he was advocating the unreasonable use of force, in other words, just for the sake of the force, not to achieve any particular results, but to show the people who is boss. And I think that mentality is very much part of it. And second point to be made is the continued attack upon the United Nations. That is to say, the United Nations is useful in Iraq. You know, they can use resolutions that the United States pushed through. Continued arrears in dues, the continued scorn for attempts at peacemaking and so on and so forth, as in Rwanda in 1994. But essentially, the United Nations is a contemptible body, and as most people in the Senate and the House boast, they've never been out of the United States, don't even have a passport. So why should we care about the world body that gives that tries to take sovereignty away from the United Nations? I think that's also part of it. That the United, I mean, this is an assertion of world number one without much interest at all in any possible outcome that anyone can possibly see is anything but bleak.
Edward Said and Noam Chomsky speaking last Friday at a forum at Columbia University in Manhattan, a forum sponsored by the Italian Academy for Advanced Studies in America, in the question-answer period, talking about the bombing of Yugoslavia. We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll get Noam Chomsky's response to the issue of irrational behavior. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. So we move on with our war and peace report. We started it during the bombing of Iraq, now dealing with the bombing of Yugoslavia, and bring to a conclusion the discussion between Columbia University professor Edward Said and MIT professor Noam Chomsky on the bombing. This is Professor Chomsky.
Let me just say that on this matter of looking irrational, Thomas Friedman didn't make it up. That's official U.S. policy.
It is, yeah.
There is a national defense, forget the name of it, in 1995, which proposed that, it's been partially declassified, which proposed that the United States should maintain an irrational posture. We should look like a dangerous, irrational state, because that will frighten people, and we should use the nuclear arsenal that way. The more uncertain they are, the more power we have. Now, there's actually an Orwellian phrase for this, which is repeated by Clinton and his little puppy dog, Tony Blair, and Madeleine Albright, and everyone else. The phrase is, we have to preserve the credibility of NATO. That's the main argument that's given. Well, try to decode that. I mean, are they worried about the credibility of Denmark, you know, or of Italy? You know? No. Credibility of NATO means credibility of the United States. Now, what does credibility mean? Well, credibility means like what any mafia don would understand. If somebody doesn't pay, you know, what they're supposed to do in a grocery store, the don has to maintain credibility. Other people have to understand that you don't do this. You know, credibility means be frightened of the enforcer. So once you carry out the translation, I think you can see what's going on. And I think it's exactly what Edward said. That's a major motivation. You have to preserve the credibility of the enforcer. And if you do it by being irrational and violent and destructive, well, you know, that's where the cookie crumbles.
I have a tiny footnote to this is to bring it back to the Middle East. I mean, it's the rationale for Israeli policy in Lebanon. Yeah, you know, where you know, you occupy a strip of land, you say this is to protect yourself, so you occupy more land inside another sovereign state. And then you mete out punishment through mercenaries, but certainly by, you know, the clean bombing, you know, the use of aircraft and so on and so forth. And then, of course, when you meet resistance, you call them terrorists. And it's what's interesting is how the U.S. press has followed along with this logic, so that whenever they talk about the Hezbollah guerrillas in southern Lebanon fighting the Israeli occupation, they're always referred to as Iran-supported terrorists, Hezbollah, and so on and so forth. But the footnote I wanted actually to bring attention to was around the just before the middle of March, it must have been around the 11th or 12th of March, the Israelis invaded further north. They took another area in a town called Announ, just north of the security zone in southern Lebanon, and they surrounded it. They took the village, kicked out most of the inhabitants, and put barbed wire around it. A couple of days later, there were big demonstrations in Beirut, and a bunch of students came down from Beirut by bus to Announ in south Lebanon, to this newly occupied town north of the Israeli zone, but which was just recently occupied by the Israelis. And they stood in front of the barbed wire, warned off the Israelis, shot rifles in the air, warned that the wires were full of electricity, that there were landmines and so on and so forth. And then, you know, as it happens in situations of crowds and so on, a couple of them, of the Lebanese students, attacked the barbed wire, which of course was not wired, there were no landmines, and liberated the town. And the Israeli soldiers, with all their arms, ran away. It's a small episode in a generally not very distinguished history of conflict, but it does show at times that the bully can be confronted.
We have to stop, so would you please join me in thanking Noam Chomsky and Edward Said?
Did you read about Announ yet?
That was Edward Said and Noam Chomsky, Professor Edward Said of Columbia University, Professor of English and Comparative Literature, and Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political analyst, critic, and linguist, speaking at Columbia University last Friday at a forum on Middle East politics sponsored by the American Academy, sponsored by the Italian Academy for Advanced Studies in America. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. While the topic of their main addresses was not the bombing of Yugoslavia, they were addressing a question that was asked in the question and answer period. Well, we're going to move on now to some different points of view of the bombing of Yugoslavia. Later that night and through the weekend, this past weekend, the 1999 Socialist Scholars Conference took place at the Borough of Manhattan Community College in New York. The Socialist Scholars Conference is an annual tradition, a project of the City University of New York chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. The man who chaired the event is Bogdan Denic. We've had him on our airwaves before. He is a Serb professor from the group Transitions to Democracy, and he is actually for the bringing in of ground troops to deal with the Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic. After him, we'll hear from Ian Williams, who writes for The Nation magazine at the United Nations. The MC of this forum was Branka Sesto from the United Nations Human Rights Office. We begin with Bogdan Denic, who is responding to a German member of parliament who was speaking out against the bombing and against NATO's action. This is Bogdan Denic.
We denounce the ethnic cleansing of Croatia. My organization has fought it day and night. Branko Sesto, who sits there in our activists, fight it in Croatia and fought it in Serbia. We do not need lessons on fighting ethnic cleansings. For 10 long years, that is what my organization and I have been doing. We've been denouncing the U.S. indifference on that, and we've been denouncing the interests of the left in New York, including your party, on that. I did not see them running demonstrations against the crimes in Kosovo by the Serbs, the crimes against the
That's
Serbs
wrong,
in Kosovo. Excuse
That's
me.
Wrong,
I did not.
It's slander. It's wrong.
Okay. I did not see in the media mass demonstrations like the
media.
Demonstrations against the bombing directed against the Tudjman and the Milosevic regime when they engaged in their massive ethnic cleansing, nor did I see mass demonstrations to raise money to help those Democrats who are now in peril. I have spent time raising that goddamn money and a number of other people that I know of. But most of the people who are now weeping tears for the Democrats in Belgrade didn't do diddly to do that. So I don't want to hear any more of that stuff. They didn't put their bodies on the line, they didn't put their money on the line, and they didn't put any pressure.
But now, about ground troops. What do you know about PDS, please? What do you know?
That's
wrong. I'm sorry.
Don't take that off my time, Branka.
I can't answer that. Get the time.
No, sorry. Wolfgang, you can debate that afterwards as long as you like.
Now,
Bogdan, continue.
I was asked a couple of questions. Most of them, I don't want to go into legalities and so on. I, of course, like Fridtjof Tigerson, would prefer to see an international force reflecting the world's population capable of intervening in these brush wars, capable of intervening against the Pol Pots, against the Turkish government and the many other things. And incidentally, we have called for denunciation of what is happening, what was happening against the Kurds and what's happening to the Palestinians. Anybody who denies that simply does not know what the Socialist Scholars Conference and the DSA were like. We denounced the bombing of Iraq. We were against the intervention in the Gulf. Many of you were present. It happened to be one of the rare resolutions, because we don't adopt resolutions, adopted at my urging at the Socialist Scholars Conference. I am for sending in ground troops for a very simple reason. It is the only way I know of to protect the civilian population. It is the only way to assure that autonomy of Kosovo will be protected, because there's not an agreement which Milosevic has not broken. If he signs an agreement, we have no way of preventing him from violating the way he has violated endless agreements, like tyrants usually do. The reason that an unarmed observer should not be in Kosovo is because they're merely hostages. They were threatened by armed Serb police and not permitted to carry out the jobs. The reason the ground troops would not be as great a problem as people think is that the argument against intervening against Yugoslavia was the heroic tradition of guerrilla warfare against the Germans. The guerrilla in Kosovo would not be Serb. The guerrilla in Kosovo would be anti-Serb. The guerrilla in Kosovo would be Albanian. And I'm against going on to Belgrade. I'm for establishing a safety zone in Kosovo. I don't think that the Serbs have sovereignty over it and have a right to have a sovereignty over it. I think the people living there have it, and I want them to be able to vote after a cooling-off period, and I want an international force precisely to prevent the massacre of the Serb minority in there. I'm, after all, a Serb. I do have some affection for my people, but not for the regime. This regime is the worst calamity that could possibly have happened to the Serb people. This regime has done more harm to the Serb people than all of its enemies put together. It has emptied out the Serb population from Croatia by egging them into a war they were bound to lose. It has halved the Serb population in Bosnia. It has devastated the economy of Serbia. I think that toppling Milosevic is a major task for the Democrats, and Milosevic and Tudjman will have to go if there's to be a peace in the area.
Thank you. Jan, I suggest that you go now, and then I will Jan should speak now, and I will donate my time, and I will just say one last sentence afterwards. Because if we have to finish at 10 to 3, there won't be time. Okay.
That was Professor Bogdan Epps.
I'm very touched by
the
concern for bourgeois legalism in the revolutionary masses here. Let me produce one. Pinochet. What rights did the imperialist British have to get a sovereign senator from another country for crimes committed against the nationals of another country? And yet a third one. What type of bourgeois globalism is this, comrades? And I'll tell you, it's bloody good. That's what it is. I was very proud that it was a Labour government in Britain that said, yes, the bastard could be extradited. I was very, very proud. And now I'm being told that we can't go and get somebody who's committing murders now and do anything about him. Because, oh, there's national sovereignty. Oh, no, there's this law that hasn't been obeyed. You've got to push this button before you do it. So it's all right, I presume, from our comrades on the left who opposed what happened in Chile, that we arrest somebody for crimes committed 20 years ago. But we can't do anything now. The bourgeois legality coming out. When I wander past and see someone being beaten up, I don't go and ask them what the reason was. I stop it. I intervene personally. In fact, if you want some bourgeois legality, in common law there's a crime called misprision of felony. And it involves walking past a crime and doing nothing about it. And that's what most of the West and most of the world has been doing for the last 10 years. And I agree with you. Rwanda, Kurdistan, there's lots of places. And I've written about those as well. This sudden access of virtue. If I saw a murder happening, what'd you say? Oh, that was nothing. You should have seen the Yorkshire Ripper. Mm-hmm. What do you do about the Yorkshire Ripper then? I did nothing about the Yorkshire Ripper. But let me tell you, if I'd found him, I would have done. And if I could have done, I would have done. This excuse for inaction that comes out, this sort of parallelism, totally spurious parallelism. People here have spoken about Turkey and Kurdistan. People here have spoken about Cambodia. People here have shouted about Rwanda. I watched Madeleine Albright stop a UN peacekeeping operation going into Rwanda because she had to go to the Senate and ask for $36 million otherwise. And then I watched the spineless cretin in the White House shell out $1.5 billion for relief to pick up the bodies afterwards. You've no need to convince me about the morality. I'm come from Britain. I'd be speaking German now if it wasn't for the imperialist Roosevelt intervening in 1941. Do you think that he came because my father's house was bombed? No. Do you think he came because Britain was suffering and the torpedoes were knocking the food ships? No. They came because American interests were at stake. Stalin, nice old Uncle Joe. Until Germany attacked him, this was a social imperialist war, and with language very reminiscent of some people here, he was denouncing the imperialist British Navy for starving Germans by blockading Nazi Germany. Do you hear some echoes here tonight? We're talking about real people dying. We're not talking about abstract constructs here. We're talking about democratic socialists who all of us have qualms about this and are arguing the points one by one and trying to work it out. And those who've come with a prefixed line that somehow Milosevic is the last surviving socialist in the world. He is not a socialist. Serbia is not a socialist country. It is a vicious, racist dictatorship. In fact, Milosevic is so cynical, he's not even a nationalist. He's used nationalism. Tudjman, now he's a nationalist. The next best war criminal unhung, I'll give you that.
Here,
but that doesn't justify what Milosevic
you
is doing.
Because I am going to speak about Tudjman and Milosevic. Thank you.
For Tudjman, I defer to our comrade.
That was the nation's Ian Williams. Now to Branka Sesto of the United Nations Human Rights Office.
Okay. But before I say my last few words about Tudjman and Milosevic, I would like to mention another very popular, I think one of the Bogdan's most popular politicians of that region, and that is former Kingdom of Yugoslavia's Prime Minister, Mr. Pašić. He had some kind of a debate, and then he agreed with the first speaker, and then another speaker spoke, and he says, I agree with you. And then the third speaker said something else, and he said, yes, I agree with you. And then somebody said, like, well, Mr. Prime Minister, how come you are agreeing with everybody and they've been speaking opposite things? And he says, well, young man, I agree with you too. So that's from Mr. Pašić. And I would also like to say that I agree with you all. Absolutely. Almost. Maybe one and a half statements I've heard would be something that I wouldn't agree with. But I certainly do not agree with somebody who says that Milosevic is a socialist. Please do not offend any decent socialist in the world and in Serbia. You know, Tudjman, who doesn't pretend to be a socialist, I mean, he is an anti-socialist. He actually wants capitalism, and he wants to bring back some kind of nobility and royalty to Croatia. I think he sees himself as a king. And then he wants his first kins and his children and grandsons to quickly absorb a lot of might. His grandson has a bank already, his daughter and sons have wealth, incredible, and so on and so on. But so does Milosevic's daughter and son. And all the kids of these bastards have all this wealth, which reminds me, resembles to what somebody said today, yesterday. Daniel said that one bourgeois liberal money player wins more in one day than a worker in 150,000 years.
Branka Sesto of the United Nations Human Rights Office, wrapping up the discussion on war and peace in Kosovo with Ian Williams of The Nation magazine and Bogdan Denich, Serb professor at the University, City University of New York, with the group Transitions to Democracy. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we go from the war abroad to the war at home, a speech at the Socialist Scholars Conference by Michael Eric Dyson. Please stay with us.
To tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it rain.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we conclude today's show with the speech of Professor Michael Eric Dyson, who is now a visiting professor at Columbia University on African American Studies. He spoke Friday night at the opening plenary of the Socialist Scholars Conference, dealing with the issues of race, class, and freedom.
In the 15 minutes I have, I'm going to talk about freedom, mainly in the via negativa. That is, to suggest by talking about those folk who ain't free, and then perhaps talk about what freedom means in that implicit and an inductive sense. First of all, the poor are not free. When we think about the global reality of capitalism, and when we think about the deep and pervasive problem of poverty in the world, it is made all the worse because of the great concentration of wealth throughout the world, and especially in a nation like the United States. The reality is that 225 of the richest people in the world have a combined wealth of $1 trillion. And that is equal to the combined income of the poorest 47% of the world's 2.5 billion population. That means then that 25% of the super rich, which is about 60 people, live right here in the United States with a combined wealth of over $300 billion. The world's three richest people have total assets worth more than the total gross domestic product of the 48 poorest countries in the world. Now, it would only take another $40 billion per year to provide access to food, to safe water, to education, to health care, to women's reproductive health care, and to sanitation for all the world's people. So it's clear that the poor are not free because they don't have economic self-determination. They do not have the capacity to be able to get up every day and to feed themselves or to feed their families. They do not have the freedom to engage in the sort of health maintenance that allows them to police the progression of disease in their bodies or to prevent its rising in the first place. The mass of people throughout the globe who are poor are not free because their children are not educated. Not only are they underschooled, but the schools that they attend continue to leverage its authority against their best interests, and as a result of that, refuses to allow them a critical pedagogy, a style of learning that would allow them to examine, to interrogate, and to scrutinize the very propositions, the very principles, the very preoccupations of the state, of the city, of the government that continues to make their lives a living hell. The poor are not free because of the advancement of technology, large transnational corporations and mergers, the increasing glut of products and competition for markets, the unrestrained, if you will, speculation and deregulation, devastation and devaluation of money, the accelerating race to the bottom, if you will, in wages for working people, the destabilization of the middle class, and the extraordinary intensification of the political attack on the most vulnerable. The poor are not free because they don't have not only economic and material resources, but because they are not allowed to gather what we might term their moral or their spiritual forces in defense of themselves either. It is not that the state regulates ethical principles or moral practices. It is that we cannot expect the requisite moral behavior of people who live in oppressive conditions without understanding what constrains them. Dorothy Day said, "I want to work toward a world in which it's possible for people to behave decently." And so when we have these narratives of criminality, when we have these ideologies of stigmatizing and victimizing the victim, what we should pay attention to is how people are allowed to behave decently and how decent behavior is not predicated upon material wealth or upon economic wherewithal, but it is intimately linked to them, and we must be cautious and careful about those links. But not only are the poor... not only are the poor not free, those who are imprisoned, obviously, are not free. And when we think about how we spend $25,000 a year on prisoners, much less than we spend per person or per child for going to college or even for schooling. The fastest growing industry in America is the prison industry. We spend up to $101 billion each year for local, state, and federal criminal justice agencies. Prison and security guards are one of the top 10 fastest growing jobs in this country. The FBI is now developing 20 new prisons at the cost of $4.3 billion. And in California, more than 20 new prisons have opened since 1984, while only one new campus was added to California State in the same time. So what the real deal is that higher education receives about 8.7% of the state's general funding, while prisons receive 9.6% of the funding. More than 1.5 million people in this nation are in prison. Over 70% of those are people of color. More than 5 million people are under surveillance of the criminal justice system. In 1990, 58.2% of all people who were jailed were unemployed at the time of their arrest. 68% of them earned less than $15,000 a year. The reality then is that in American society, that people who are imprisoned are not free because they do not have the possibility of preventing often their going to prison by requisite health care, by requisite school, by requisite attempts to get jobs, or by the possibility of reconstructing the very communities in which they live. The reality then is that those who are in prison are not free, if you will, balance stigma, especially of Latino and African-American youth. Overwhelmingly, those who are targeted by the criminal justice system and stigmatized for the rest of their lives are young Black Latino men and African-American men, and increasingly women, because our prisons are not simply being swollen by the masses of Black and brown bodies who happen to be men. They are increasingly women, and women with health care problems and women with children. And as a result of that, those people are not free because we live in the richest country in the world with an inglorious concentration of wealth at the heart of this society, but with a heartless disregard for those people, and it ends up being racist and classist and sexist at the same time. And we talk about, rightly so, about the hemorrhaging of industrial resources in a post-industrial urban complex, and the move to the suburbs of, you know, jobs, and how the transportation network goes out there, and how 5 million jobs have been lost to manufacturing sectors in the last 20 years. The reality is many of those jobs are now going behind prison walls. Motorola, IBM, Compaq, TWA, and Best Westerns are now paying prisoners anywhere from 30 cents to $2.15 an hour for jobs that used to be occupied by people making a so-called decent wage in the free working world. What is wrong with that picture? Not only are we imprisoning people at a disproportionate rate, stigmatizing them as a result of racial and class antagonism, but we are making prisoners of those for whom those jobs are taken. So both those in prison are not free, and those who are imprisoned by capitalism's operation outside are not free as well. And finally, my brothers and sisters, my comrades, the reality is that those who are subject to police brutality ain't free. And that's why many of us, especially here in New York, some thousand of us went down to get arrested, and others protested against police brutality. And it seems that we would be way past police brutality by now. That's like a 1950s issue, ain't it? 1960s issue. That's like some severe anachronism, isn't it? That's like an illogical kind of process. But yet here we are in 1999. And the reality is that police brutality continues to operate, and it doesn't simply harm black and brown people, even though they are its immediate victims. It harms all of us. Can we really believe, can we really think that if 10 young white men or women had been mowed down by police people in the United States of America, that there would not be an all-out pursuit of those people, even if they were in police uniforms, to make sure that they would never do that again? And so the reality is that we've got to then come to grips with the origins of police brutality and its lethal manifestation, the lethal limits it imposes upon the variability of people to live. I have so many friends who say when the cops stop them, they get out and they challenge them and they charge them and they speak, you know, to them in a very powerful way. I don't have that luxury. I want to live the next day to write some more books, to preach some more sermons, to talk to my children. So the reality is, in American society, police brutality is vicious because it is the frontline assault not only of the American police state, it is the frontline assault of the concentration of capital in the hands of those who continue to regulate the lives of those who are poor and those who are most vulnerable. And that is why even hip-hop culture is concerned about this. When we were listening in 1988 to F the Police coming straight from the underground, a young nigga got it bad because I'm brown and not the other color. Some police think they have the authority to kill a minority. This is why Tupac Shakur even said, I got arrested the other day by some crooked cops, and to this day, those cops on the beat get major pay. But when I get my check, they taking tax out, so we paying the cop to knock the blacks out. So that wasn't a kind of Marxist or Weberian conception of social theodicy. Right? That wasn't no sophisticated analysis about the way in which the concentration of wealth in the hands of the very few undermines the lives of the many, but it was a powerful frontline report, a kind of informal ethnography about the effects of police brutality and why we must do away with this once and for all. Well, then what is freedom? Freedom is the ability to get up every day regardless of your sex, regardless of your race, regardless of your class, and be able to talk to your children, to love your husband or wives or partners, or your dogs or your cats or whatever else you've accumulated to engage in reciprocal affection. This microphone, that chair, whatever floats your boat. The freedom to be able to celebrate one's life in the fullness and vigor of one's own body without having disease interpenetrate with the process of living, so that you're not living next to a dump because of your class or gender or race, and that you are not subject to the tyranny of male supremacy in an American society and globally that refuses to acknowledge the centrality of women's bodies. This is what freedom means to us. And so freedom means deeply being human without the lethal impositions of the state and without the unfair regulation of our ability to love and speak to one another. If you don't mind, I'm going to end then with one of these old little Baptist stories. I'll just tell one of these little Baptist preacher stories. You know, there was a man who was, busy, and his daughter was bothering him, and he wanted to get rid of her, so he gave her a little game to play, and she came back in 5 minutes, and it was over, and he still didn't have enough time, so he said, okay, I'll think of something else. And so he gave her a puzzle to solve, and she came back, and the puzzle was solved. He says, I know what I'll do. He looked over, and he saw a picture of the world, and he cut it up into, like, 60 or 70 different parts. He said, I know what. I'll give her this puzzle to put back together and tear the world up like I'm doing here and cut it up, and then it'll be at least 4 or 5 hours before she puts this thing together. So he carved it up way before balkanization went down. He carved it up way before issues and ideologies of white supremacy versus other forms of ethnic cleansing came up. He carved the world up before the rise of certain vicious ideologies that privilege uncritically the celebration of people's own lives, whether they were men or whether they were rich or whether they were older. The reality is that he carved it up, and then he carved this world up and gave it to her, and she came back in 5 minutes with the world put together. He said, my God, how did you do this? How did you get this world back together so fast? She said, oh, Daddy, that's simple. On the back of that map that you cut up. On the back of that world was a picture of a human being's face. And when I put that human being's face together, my world came together. Now, I don't know about you, but the bottom line for me is that that's what freedom is about. The ability of all of us to celebrate the dignity of our human identities, no matter how they are manifest. And when we can acknowledge that, when we can get the human face together, when we can get our human community together, when we can get our human relationships together, when we are allowed to live and engage one another as full, equal human beings in the process of living, then the world can come together. Then, in the final analysis, we will be able to celebrate one another. We will be able to stamp out the ills of the world, at least keep them at bay, and at the same time be able to prevent others from eroding the freedom of others. Mark Twain said that it's because of God's graciousness that we have three unshakable realities: the freedom of speech, the freedom of conscience, and he said, thirdly, was the prudence not to exercise either. Well, I don't, but I think we should have the improper, if you will, authority given to us not by on high, but given to us by the permission of human beings, that is, living in community, to exercise those freedoms. If we do not exercise the freedom to speak, the freedom to talk, the freedom to think, the freedom to walk, the freedom to engage in loving and living, then we will not be free, because none of us will be free. In the final analysis, we are not only in the same boat, we are in the same stream. And if that stream is poisoned, if that environment is torn down, if that ecology is polluted with bigotry and bias, then none of us will be able to breathe the air of freedom. Until that time, let us continue to oppose the vicious bigotries that continue to blind us. Let us take down the walls that continue to divide us, and let us build up the possibility of destroying the factors that destroy those people who are poor, those people who do not have the wherewithal to make sure that they can live in this nation or in this world, without the nasty, devastating imposition from the state or from nature on their lives. Comrades, let us keep up the struggle.
Michael Eric Dyson, speaking at the Socialist Scholars Conference in New York City at the City University of New York. He's author of books on gangster rap and Malcolm X, minister and visiting professor of African American Studies at Columbia University. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program that includes the discussion between Edward Said and Noam Chomsky on Kosovo, the dissenting views from Said and Chomsky of Bogdan Denich and Ian Williams, and the speech of Michael Eric Dyson, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Tomorrow on the program, Phil Berrigan.
Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?